So while you're turning to Isaiah, let's see if we can get our books of our prophets in order. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Oh, we're getting better. The voices are getting stronger every time. There's always a few that are Isaiah, Jeremiah. Yeah. Last phrase we read there in verse 25, for all this, his anger has not turned away and his hand is stretched out still. That's going to be a phrase that's going to be used another four or five times throughout the book to illustrate that God's judgment is firm. He's not going to let Israel out of this thing. So he has, in this chapter, pronounced several woes, using that word as a way to highlight the crimes that Israel has committed. You know, like living the party life, oppressing their neighbors, worshiping other gods and things. And so he has said in verse 25, therefore the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people, and he stretched out his hand against them and struck them. And the mountains quaked, and their corpses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. So there's a very bleak picture of what God is going to do to Israel because of all her sin. So ask yourself this question: how seriously does God take sin? How seriously do we take it? Or do we just brush it off? It's no big deal. To God, it is a big deal. And he does bring judgment. We don't want to take his grace lightly. For all this, his anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. He will raise a signal for nations far away and whistle for them from the ends of the earth. And behold, quickly and speedily they come. So how is God going to accomplish this judgment on Israel? With speed and using other nations. So he's raising a signal for the nations. He's like, hey, flag them down. I want that nation over there. He's going to name them later. Right now he's just telling us he's going to use a different nation to discipline Israel. And it's a faraway nation. I love that imagery. Whistle for them from the ends of the earth. Anybody know how to do the, like, put your fingers in your mouth, whistle kind of thing? No? I never could figure out how to do that, so I'm always just... I'm pretty amazing at it already. He's going to call other nations in to discipline Israel, and as Kim said, they're going to do their work speedily. What really is amazing is when you look at the history of the world and the rise of big empires, guess when they start? Right here. Why does God start allowing these massive world-dominating empires to come in? Because he's using them to deal with Israel. Israel really is the center of God's program for the history of this world. And so we'll take a look at some of those other historical tidbits here to come. But he's got the description continues in a very picturesque way. None is weary, none stumbles, none slumbers or sleeps. Not a waistband is loose, not a sandal is broken. Why does he tell us all this? What's this picture elicit for you?
It's ready and it's coming.
It's ready. This is a well-prepared army. This isn't going to be some haphazard band of people. This isn't just a bunch of thieves and brigands. Their roaring is like a lion. Like young lions they roar. They growl and seize their prey. They carry it off and none can rescue. They will growl over it on that day like the growling of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold darkness and distress, and the light is darkened by its clouds. This is an unstoppable force. They are hungry for war. Why? Because God's using this nation to discipline his people Israel. Once again, he hasn't identified who this nation is yet, but he's going to very, very soon. So, for all of Israel's sins, God is going to bring in a nation from far away and use that nation to wreak havoc on his people of Israel. So these are some of the first glimpses we get of what later we're going to know is the Babylonian captivity and the Assyrian dispersion of the people of Israel. But he's prophesying about it all 100 years before it happens, in some cases almost 200 years. And then we move into chapter 6. Very, very popular chapter. This one preaches really well because it's got such great imagery in it. But he starts off with these little historical tidbits. In the year that King Uzziah died. Now, we saw in the beginning of the book of Isaiah, during which kings does Isaiah prophesy? Uzziah's the first one, right? Yeah, Uzziah. Uzziah's son Jotham. Jotham's son Ahaz. And Ahaz's, would it be Ahaz's? Yeah, Ahaz's son Hezekiah. Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. He spans almost 70 years in his prophecies. So this one, he gives us a very firm date. It's the year that King Uzziah died. Now, if any of you remembers your history a little bit, you will remember that Uzziah was a righteous king who ruled for 52 years, one of the longest kingships in Israel. Isaac Newton calculated the average length of the reign of a king and found it to be 14 years. Throughout history, the average length of a king was 14 years. And he used that to measure when claims were made about how far back in history something happened. Like some of the civilizations, like the Greeks, would claim such and such happened, you know, thousands of years ago. And then he would look at the king list and say it couldn't have been. The average length of a king is 14 years, and they can list 13 kings between that event and this event. That means it couldn't be any farther back than this. And so he uses that in his dating system to show that King David really was one of the first major world empires. God exalted David's kingdoms. David and Solomon were one of the very first world-dominating empires. I mean, there were other big kingdoms out there, like the Hittites and the Egyptians, but David's kingdom surpassed them all until we get to these new kingdoms. So Uzziah reigned for a very long time, and he was a righteous king, except that toward the end of his reign, he grew arrogant, and he went into the temple to offer incense on the altar of incense. Well, that was forbidden for anybody but the priests to do. And so God disciplined him by striking him with leprosy. And because he had leprosy, he was now excluded from temple worship and from all public life. So he retreated, finished out his years living in isolation as a leper, which means he couldn't rule the kingdom. And so for the last 4 or 5 years, his son Jotham sort of took over the responsibilities of the kingdom without actually being king. But then Uzziah died. And so, if Isaiah says that in the year that King Uzziah died, we know that Uzziah's death has already happened. So we're in the later part of the year. Uzziah died, which means Jotham, his son, has now been made the full king. But that helps us date this very easily to 759 BC. That's the year that King Uzziah died, and Jotham becomes the full king. So, now let's read the description of what's going on. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Why are we getting this description? This is the Lord Jesus, yes. Yep. But he sees him in a particular way. He notes these details. He's sitting on what? A throne. What's a throne signify?
Leadership.
And he's high and lifted up. Why is that a significant detail? Yeah, even today in our modern architecture, our important government officials take positions of height. Have you ever been in the courtroom? Where does the judge sit and where do you sit? Well, you don't sit. Why is that? It's intimidation, right, Elton? The judge sits on his bench, which is always built on a platform up above you so that he's looking down on you. This, don't make any mistake about this. This is an intimidation factor. You are in the presence of an authority that is greater than you are, so you'd better submit to it. All of the kings of the ancient world did this. Solomon did it. He had a throne built out of ivory and overlaid with gold that had, I think, 12 steps going up to it. Why? So that when he's sitting on the throne, he's above everybody else in a very visible way, saying, I'm higher than you are. I have more power than you do. So just submit. Don't fight this. So when Isaiah sees the Lord sitting on a throne high and lifted up, it is a very powerful picture of the authority of God. Who's above him in authority? Nobody. Nothing. There is no authority greater than God's. Nobody can challenge his rulings. There's no court of appeal to what he decides. Nobody can overthrow him. You know, in human governments, we have all kinds of tiers of judges, from local judges all the way up to our Supreme Court. And even then, if they make a decision that we kind of don't like, there is a way around it. We can have our Congress pass a constitutional amendment. And if Congress makes decisions, I mean, there's that whole balance of power things that we recognize in our country, but if we don't like the decision, or if, I should say it this way, if some other country doesn't like the decision that our country makes, there's always a final appeal. It's called war. If we really don't like something another country does, we can go to war with them to try to put a stop to it. But who's going to fight against God? Who can successfully wage a war against him? This entire picture here is, and it's just in this one verse. I mean, it keeps going, but even just this one simple verse tells us that God is the exalted king. And Isaiah is going to recognize that in his confession here in just a minute. There's nobody higher than God. There's nobody stronger than God. There's nobody more glorious than God. Nobody more majestic than God. He is high. He is lifted up. The train of his robe filled the temple. Any of you brides have big trains on your gowns? It's not as much of a thing anymore. But it's a thing to create this picture of beauty and elegance and majesty. Eldon, you had a big train on your wedding gown?
I just want to say, I saw something on television years ago.
Uh-huh.
There used to be a comedian by the name of Ed Wynn. Most people here don't know who he was. But anyway, one time on the television show, this couple came out, this bride came out. Mm-hmm. And he was on the train of the bride, and he come out, fell off the stool, and she stopped, and he says, "Oh," he says, "I just love to ride on trains."
Oh boy. Well, the idea is the longer the train, it's supposed to be more beautiful, more elegant. And God's train fills the temple. Which, by the way, there is a heavenly temple. When Moses built the tabernacle, God commanded him and said, you know, be sure that you build this tabernacle according to the pattern you saw on the mountain. That's not a set of blueprints, by the way. Moses was shown this heavenly temple and told to replicate it as best he could with earthly materials. Well, verse 2, above him stood the seraphim. Now here's where things really start to get strange, because this is going to be otherworldly. Don't look for earthly comparisons. Isaiah's trying to do it with the wings and things, but this is weird because these don't exist in our world. The seraphim, which is a plural word. Anytime you see in most of your translations, I don't know if anybody's not translated seraphim, they say something else. I'm curious. I'm just thinking of this, so I'm going to follow a little rabbit trail here and see what else they say.
Seraphs.
Okay. Seraphim. Seraphims is the KJV. Seraphim. The Seraphim NIV, the Seraphim New King James. Yeah, all the ones I've got listed here are saying Seraphim. So what are you reading from? Oh, okay. Yep. And it says seraphs. All right. Now, that's an English rendering of it. So the Hebrew word is seraph, and it means the light ones, or the light being kind of thing. And seraphim is plural. In Hebrew, if you heard the word im at the end, that's a pluralization of it. Even the word Elohim that we use for God is a plural form. Isn't that interesting? New Testament almost always uses the word Elohim, talking about God, as if he's plural. I wonder what that might be. Yeah. So anyway, the seraphim are above him. Each one had six wings. With two, he covers his face. With two, he covers his feet. And with two, he flew. Really phenomenal picture here. Even the seraphs are not comfortable being in the presence of God exposed. And so they cover their faces and they cover their feet with their wings. Isn't that amazing? Well, that's going to lead us to what happens here in just a minute with Isaiah's response. Verse 3, one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." This kind of worship is continually going on in the heavenly temple. And they are powerful voices. Verse 4, the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. Whoever built this heavenly temple must have really good technology to guard against earthquakes. Because how these things can be continually rattling the foundations with their booming voices, but it's never destroyed. It's beautiful. It's an amazing thing to contemplate, the heavenly temple. But there's the worship that's going on in there, and just all of it screams out glory. God is a glorious God. He is majestic. Our words just fall short of describing who God is. Isaiah is trying here because, again, he's using this imagery. They have six wings, but they cover their face, they cover their feet. You get to Ezekiel and you see these things full of eyes all over the place. And it's like, this is, it looks alien. Because God didn't create any of these to dwell with us, not on this earth. And we don't know how much access Adam had to spiritual and heavenly things before the fall. But the heavenly realm is alien to us. It looks strange. It looks weird. And you see that in them wrestling to try to find descriptions, especially when we get to Ezekiel and he starts talking about the wheels within the wheels. Like, he's fighting to describe it. He's sitting there looking at it saying, how do I describe that? I've never seen anything like that before. Well, Isaiah's response is telling. Verse 5, I said, woe is me. Now, what did he just use the woes for in chapter 5? What's that? Curses. Yeah, condemnations against the people of Israel. Woe to them who do this. Woe to them who do this. God's bringing judgment, and Isaiah, standing in the presence of God, says, woe is on me. I'm the one that deserves these curses. Why? Because I'm lost. I'm undone. I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. So who's the King? Really fascinating, if you love language and grammar, to study the uses of the definite article, the. I know. I just see all of you reeling with excitement at that prospect, right? Yeah. I want to read a grammar book on the definite article, the. One of the uses of the, if you think about how often we use that word, that is the word that occurs the most times in the English language, because we use it all over the place, but that tells you how many different ways we can use it. Well, one of the ways is to point out something that is the epitome. Like there's no other. He's the King. All the other things we call kings, they're not really kings. He's the King. He's the one and only. He's the epitome. He's the pinnacle of it. Right. And that's what Isaiah is pointing out here. He's the King. He's the Lord of hosts. He's the one that commands the armies. Now, that's going to be an important picture. Because who is God calling against Israel?
Assyria?
The Assyrian armies. Who's in control of this? Daniel's going to state it very, very succinctly, but Isaiah presents the same image. The Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. God calls these armies as if they're his own because he is the king. Oh, that king of Assyria that thinks he's ruling? Nope. Sorry. Nebuchadnezzar, you think you're the greatest thing on earth because God has delivered into your hand all the kingdoms of the world? Nope, that's not you. By the way, the king is going to humiliate you and make you warn around like a beast for 7 years because you thought you were so great. My eyes have seen the king, the Lord of hosts, and Isaiah falls down upon his face in terror, recognizing he has no right to be there. Besides, I mean, even the seraphims are afraid to uncover themselves in the presence of the glory of God. This is one of the ways that you know if anybody says that they have seen the Lord, if they didn't have this response, they're lying. Because every time in the Bible somebody sees the full glory of God manifest, they have the same response. They fall on their face in terror. Because God is that great, we don't have the right to exist in his presence. If we're there, it's because he wants us there, and that's it. Well, God does graciously accept. Oh, you guys remember the story of Esther? And she needs to go talk to the king. Here's kings trying to act like God. And so Esarhaddon, I think his name was, maybe it wasn't Esarhaddon, Ahasuerus, sets up this law like nobody can just approach me without me inviting them. And if they do, I'll kill them. That is when a king is trying to act like God, which kings do all the time, by the way. And she was saying, if I go in there and I present myself before the king, even though I'm his wife, and he doesn't extend to me the golden scepter, I'll die. He'll have me executed. See the picture here? The Lord of hosts is sitting on the throne. Isaiah suddenly finds himself there. He's, oh, woe is me. I'm undone. I'm going to die. And God extends the golden scepter by sending this seraphim. He takes, says he has in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away. Your sin is atoned for. Isaiah, you're covered. Now we understand from all of our other understanding of theology in the New Testament, it's not the coal that did the cleansing, right? The coal was symbolic. Who did the cleansing? Even for the Old Testament saints, who does the cleansing? Jesus does. He died for sins once. That means that one death, even though it was future to Isaiah, covered Isaiah. Just because we're on the other side of the cross doesn't mean we're treated any differently. Everybody was saved by the death of Christ, if they're saved at all. So, this is just a token for Isaiah to understand it's okay, you're not going to die. You're in the presence of God, the king, but you're not going to die. This has taken away your guilt. And I heard a voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? Isaiah's got the only response here that anybody would rightly have in hearing that call come from those lips. God called, I'll answer. Yep, here I am. And what doesn't he do first? What do you always do when pastor asks for volunteers? Can I get 5 volunteers tonight? What's it for? Yeah. What do you want me to do? I love Tim Hawkins has a little routine where he says, if the pastor comes up to you and puts his hand on your shoulder and says, you have got a servant's heart. He says, like, run, because he's going to ask you to stack chairs or do something, you know, some kind of manual labor. But Isaiah does not ask God, okay, well, oh, what is it you need? He simply says, yeah. Now that I've seen you, everything, I'm all in. Nothing's going to hold me back. I am. Here I am. Send me. And now he's going to get his message. He said, that's God said, go and say to this people, keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, excuse me, seeing, but do not perceive. So here's your message, Isaiah. Go ahead and listen, but you're not going to get it. Go ahead and watch me. I'm going to deliver a message to you, but you will not understand it and you will not listen to it. How's that for a mission? God, you're setting me up for failure? You're setting me up to go preach a message that nobody's going to listen to? By the way, this is a theme that's going to come up again and again in the prophets. God sends the prophets telling them they're not going to listen to you. What does that tell us about our mission? Success is not defined by results. Success is defined by faithfulness. You go out and preach Christ at the opportunities God gives you, you're faithful. It doesn't matter if nobody listens to you. Now that's tough because a lot of churches are built on the model of what works is what we should do. You know, we only do the things that are going to draw in big crowds. Well, that's a self-implosive philosophy, by the way. Because whatever you have to do to draw them in is what you're going to have to do to keep them, and you're going to have to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So I want to be very careful of pragmatism. But here's the message. Keep on hearing, do not understand. Keep on seeing, do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull and their ears heavy and blind their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their hearts and understand with their hearts and turn and be healed. Wait a second. I thought God wants people to turn and be healed. But he's telling Isaiah here, I want you to go and preach in order to dull their hearing. They're going to hear this message so much that they're going to stop listening to it. And they're not going to believe it. So that I can bring upon them this end of judgment. Well, that's a tough message. Eldon? Yes, he does. Yes, and he says that his preaching in parables is the ultimate fulfillment of this. Jesus preached in parables so that those people who would believe it will believe it because they'll hear it and understand it. But the people who refuse to believe it would be hardened in their unbelief. And that's what he's telling Isaiah here too. Now, Isaiah recognizes the importance of what he's being told here. Go preach. And what you're going to do is harden them and bring more guilt upon them. You're exposing them to the word of God. They're going to refuse it, and that's going to make their judgment even greater. And so Isaiah's question is, how long, O Lord? In other words, how long are they going to refuse it? I thought I was going to be sent to preach this message that they're all going to turn. Oh, you know what? Every Bible college student graduating from his 4 years of training comes into the ministry hoping he's going to change the world. And you're like, I'm going to preach Christ. Everybody's going to get saved. We're going to reform these churches, get everybody excited. It's going to be great. But then somewhere upwards of, 90% of men leave the ministry after they've been in it for 3 years? You know why? Because that doesn't happen. It doesn't look like it's going to change the world. You go out and preach, and you try to organize activities and get things done, and you get people that don't want to help you out, they don't volunteer for things, they don't listen, people don't get saved, whatever happens, and they get discouraged. Oh, it must be me, I'm a failure, I should just get out of the ministry. And God plainly tells Isaiah ahead of time, that's not what's going to happen. So don't lose heart, I want you to preach to them. Focus on being faithful. How long, O Lord? How long are they going to refuse this? And he said, until cities lie waste without inhabitant and houses without people and the land is a desolate waste and the Lord removes people far away and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. And though a tenth remain in it, it will be burned again like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains in it when it's felled. The holy seed is its stump. So how long are you going to preach? Until I have devastated this land and there's nobody left in it. Except for that one little remnant, the holy seed. You ever try to chop down a tree? You know, you cut it down and you know next year, whoop, there comes a little shoot up. And you cut that off and the next year, whoop. Why is it that mulberry trees are impossible to get out of your flower beds? I mean, I can rip those things out by the roots, it feels like, and then the next week they're growing up again. Wicked, pernicious plants those things are. Well, that's God's message to Isaiah. Here's what the king's commanding. Go preach to the people, harden their hearts until I can bring a complete and total judgment on them. All right, so how many of you want to volunteer for that mission right now? But Isaiah does. Without even thought, without hesitation, like because it's him. Because he told me to go. Because he called me to do it. Chapter 6 is the crux. Chapter 6 is what the entire book of Isaiah revolves around. That's why he didn't put it first. You know, you think Isaiah could have put this first to say, here's how I got called into ministry, but he didn't. He launched into his message, and we've already been through 5 chapters of Isaiah's message. God's calling the people, repent, you're wicked, you're doing the wrong thing. The song of the vineyard. You know, what else could I have done for my vineyard that I haven't done for it? I plowed the ground. I built up a hedgerow around it. I built a protective fortress in the middle of it. I've hoed it. I've gotten all the weeds out, separated all the rocks out of the dirt. What more could I have done? It's still bringing me wild, sour grapes. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to remove the hedge. I'm going to remove all my protection. Animals are going to trample it. Thorns are going to grow in it. And now we're getting the interpretation of that picture as garden language. We're not talking about grapes. We're talking about the people of Israel. We're not talking about stacked stone fences. We're talking about God's protection of his people. And we're not talking about animals coming in and trampling the field. We're talking about foreign armies invading and destroying the land. And what's going to stop it? Nothing is. God is going to bring this. Because this is what his people have deserved. Isn't that encouraging? What's the encouraging part about this?
God's going to preserve a small
group. Yeah, there's going to be a holy seed. There's going to be a remnant. And that's kind of a sub-theme that's going to come out throughout all of our prophecies, is that though God is bringing judgment, he always preserves for himself a remnant. Always. Elijah had to learn that. Oh, Lord, I'm the only one left. Jezebel's killing off all the prophets, and I'm the only one left in Israel. And what was God's message to him? No, you're not. I have 7,000 people that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. Now, we could do some quick demographic studies and say, 7,000, that's it? Out of all the people of Israel, there are probably several millions of people in Israel. But 7,000? That's not a very big portion of the population. But God's point was, Elijah, you're not alone. You're not the only one. And 2 chapters later, we read about one of those 7,000, and he's in the court of Ahab, the wicked king, and he's protecting the prophets of God in a cave. Now, how do you get to that top position in such a wicked government and maintain your righteousness? That's tough, but he did it. I forget the guy's name. Obadiah. Yeah, but not the one who wrote the book. Right. The real encouragement here in Isaiah chapter 6 is who's giving the message. To always keep in mind that picture. I saw the Lord high and lifted up. And the train of his robe filled the temple. And Isaiah's response to that, I have seen the king. So as we will talk about over the next couple of weeks, what happens if the election doesn't go the way you want it? I know there's a lot of talk. Does that mean the end of our country? I don't know. Could. But even if, imagine this. Imagine what's the worst thing that could possibly happen? I won't go there, but I mean, I will go there, but not right now. yeah. Oh, man. Imagine the worst thing that could happen and say, is God still in control? And folks, we do have to remember this. He is the king. The nations bend to his will. One of the messages we'll see later on, it's not all that far away, but in Isaiah, that all of the nations of the earth are like dust on the scales to him. He doesn't care. He does not care what all the nations of the earth think they have willed and think they're planning. It is not under their control. It's under his. So, should we vote? Yes, we should. Should we vote biblical principle? Yes, we should. Should we have some concern about where our country is going? Yes, we should. But don't despair, because God is still in control. Questions or comments? Isaiah 6.